Hi, I'm David Fettis, and welcome to part three of our study of the family in the Introduction to Sociology. One of the major developments in family life has been the increase of divorce. Most researchers think that women are disadvantaged by the ease of divorce. Where divorce is an option, women may feel more insecure and are therefore reluctant to push for change within a marriage. But contradicting these ideas, Kara Yudana's cross-national study of 22 countries shows that the ease of divorce increases women's equality within marriage. Divorce is a negotiating tool for women who seek change in their relationships. So you have two different kinds of claims among sociologists. One is that divorce is most of the time bad for women, and the other is that greater ease of divorce actually gives women some advantages because it gives them some bargaining power to tell their guy to shape up or ship out. In countries with greater acceptance of divorce, there is a more equal division of household work. Men risk losing their wives if they refuse to help out around the house. Not so sure about that one, but anyway, while divorce has helped women leave unhealthy marriages in which they are at risk of physical and mental harm, availability of easy divorce may also strengthen marriages. Again, the first part of the sentence is probably accurate. It helps a woman to be able to escape somebody who beats up on her or who constantly abuses her verbally and tears her down so that she can hardly remain mentally healthy anymore. So there are some situations, obviously, where divorce is better for a woman with a very cruel or mean spouse. A guy who didn't pick up the dishes quite as well, saying that she can use the divorce card to get him to pick up the dishes, that's a little too far. Anyway, availability of easy divorce, according to this researcher, may strengthen marriages. Well, we'll leave that. I'll just let you know that sociologists disagree over that. Why is divorce easier now than it used to be? Well, the laws have changed, that's one thing. No-fault divorce laws have increased since 1970s in many states and in many other countries as well. Another thing that made divorce easier is the rise of unrealistic expectations based on a cultural mystique of blissful, problem-free marriage. In previous times, there may have been just a little more practical view that, hey, marriage isn't always sweetness and bliss all the time, and you may not have your heart on fire 24 hours a day, but there's kids to bring up, there's people to take care of, there's stuff to do, so get on with it, and don't ditch somebody the moment that you don't feel that vibe anymore. And now there's expectations, among some at least, that you should have constantly this same high-level crush on a person 24/7 throughout your entire married life. And so that can be an expectation that actually hurts marriage. More women in the workforce and more independence from their husband's income means that women will choose divorce more frequently if they are in a bad situation with a man and they're able to pay the bills without him. There's also less social stigma in getting a divorce when divorce has become more widespread. If you were the only person in your church who ever got a divorce, then you might feel like a real outcast. But if you know a lot of divorced people, and your church even has a support group for divorced people, then the stigma is not so great. And that's true in wider society as well. It's just a little easier to get divorced if you don't feel like you're going to become that odd person out that everybody looks down upon. Marriage has declined and divorce has increased. Although, if you look at the red line in this little graph, you'll find that divorce has gone down somewhat in recent years as well. But part of the reason it's gone down is because marriage has gone down. There's going to be less divorces if fewer people get married in the first place. And so with more people just living together or more people just staying single much longer, there are less opportunities to divorce when fewer people are getting married. Married is still very important and very common, but less than it used to be. What about the effects of divorce? Divorced people have 20% more chronic health conditions, such as heart disease, diabetes, cancer, than do married people. And this is mainly because of two things. There's reduced income. You get poorer when there's a divorce. Assets get divided. Lawyers often have to get paid a ton of money. And so both spouses come out of it poorer, and that has a bad impact on their health. And there's also stresses over the dissolution of marriage. Even if divorce has become more common, it's not any fun. It's hard on people. And figuring things out, even after the divorce has been settled, just negotiating ongoing child care and relationships, dealing with each other, that can be hard on people. So these differences in health remain even after an individual remarries. The Bible doesn't like divorce. In Malachi chapter 2, it says, "The Lord is acting as the witness between you and the wife of your youth, because you've broken faith with her, though she is your partner, the wife of your marriage covenant. Has not the Lord made them one? In flesh and spirit, they are His. And why one? Because He was seeking godly offspring." We've seen that an intact marriage and a stable home are vital for the well-being of bringing up children. And so that's one of the reasons why God doesn't like divorce. And God also, of course, doesn't like the breaking of promises or the rending apart of what He has brought together. This doesn't mean that divorce is the unpardonable sin, but it does mean that even where it's necessary in terribly broken situations, it's not anything to celebrate or rejoice about. So guard yourself in your spirit and do not break faith with the wife of your youth. "I hate divorce," says the Lord God of Israel, "and I hate a man's covering himself with violence as with his garment," says the Lord Almighty. So guard yourself in your spirit and do not break faith. Some people are divorced through no desire or choice of their own. But people who just choose divorce because they want to trade one off for a better one, that is not God's plan at all. And when Jesus was asked about divorce, He said, "Hey, Moses allowed divorce because your hearts were hard, but that doesn't mean God liked it from the beginning or intended it to be that way." So we shouldn't stigmatize every person who's been through a divorce. But neither should we pretend that, hey, divorce is common, it happens all the time, no prob, because it's contrary to what God wanted. And even the sociologists tell us it's hard on the people who have to go through it. And sometimes it's hard on them health-wise even afterward. What about the relationship between marriage and money? While heterosexual marriage does increase the socioeconomic status of women, men reap many benefits too. For instance, while many women manage household finances, men generally retain control of the money. If they divorce, women are much less affluent, and a large percentage of divorced single women fall below poverty lines. Let's go back to the questions that were raised at the beginning. Is divorce bad for women? The claim from one researcher was that actually divorce turns out to be pretty good for them, at least the possibility of using divorce as a negotiating chip. Well, here's a more accurate statement of the wider body of social research. Women fall below the poverty line much more often if they've been through a divorce. It is just hard to be a mom having to take care of kids and not having a man who's also helping to provide income. So marriage helps people to maintain a better income and a better standard of living. Divorce often puts people, and especially the woman, in difficult economic position. And keep in mind also that the author of our textbook is heavily influenced by the ideas of feminism. And so marriage, according to many radical feminists, is just bad for women. And that there's going to be a shade of that in some of the comments we get from the textbook. Men also obtain greater mental health benefits from heterosexual marriage than do women, and report greater marital satisfaction than do women. This is likely the result of the benefits that men receive from marriage, companionship and household labor, while not having to sacrifice occupational and career advancement. Heterosexual married women, on the other hand, do often have to sacrifice career. Many skilled women leave the workforce because the work environment doesn't allow for a balance between work and family. The lack of flexible work options for women results in many of them opting out of the workforce, which is not a problem for heterosexual men. So the contention is that women have to sacrifice more for the sake of heterosexual marriage. And sometimes women are the more likely to leave the workforce because men have a hard time nursing babies. And there are other aspects, just the biological differences between men and women are significant. And you'll also find that it's still the case that many women voluntarily wish to be with their children, especially when they're small, more than they wish to be on the job, even if they enjoyed their career. This does not mean, of course, that the workplace and the environment shouldn't try to be family-friendly and work with more flexible work options. And I know just with the women that I know, some of those options have become greater in the technological society, where they can do a lot of their work at home while their children are there, and they do have a lot more flexibility than they used to. But nonetheless, a full-time career is something that many women still do give up for the sake of children, and men do that less frequently. Married women also have higher rates of mental illness than do single, widowed, and divorced women. Again, be careful what you read from a sociologist. If you look at the footnote on this particular claim, they cite one study that was done way back in 1972. So the study is way decades old. Nothing else has substantiated it. And the fact of the matter is that most studies would find that married people are doing very well, sometimes better than single people. Women who marry at a younger age generally have lower educational attainment, though the causal direction here goes both ways. Sometimes if you marry, you're less likely to finish your college. Sometimes you're just, if you're not a college person, in your mentality, you say, hey, I can get married because I don't have to be 22 and have 4 years of college behind me. But anyway, women who marry at a younger age have lower schooling, they have more kids, and they're often more dependent on their husbands financially. Especially in a knowledge-based society, if you don't have college training, then you're going to be very heavily dependent on your spouse's income, especially if there's children to take care of. Marriage involves the church, marriage involves the state, it involves religious and civil authorities. The participants in a marriage usually seek social recognition for their relationship, and many societies require official approval of a religious or a civil body, that is, of the church or the state. In many jurisdictions, the civil marriage ceremony may take place during the religious marriage ceremony, although they're theoretically distinct. So in some of the marriages at which I've officiated, I say, by the authority of God and the authority vested in me by the state, I now pronounce you husband and wife. I'm making a declaration that is both spiritual and religious, as well as speaking on behalf of the state, because the state has said, hey, we recognize marriages that are officiated by a minister. So there are marriages that involve both the church and the state. In most American states, the marriage may be officiated by a priest, minister, rabbi, or other religious authority. And in such a case, the religious authority acts simultaneously as an agent of the state. In some countries, though, such as France, Spain, Germany, Turkey, Argentina, and Russia, it's necessary to be married by the state before having a religious ceremony. And even in the United States, often people will go and get a marriage license from the state, and then things get ratified and official on their official marriage day. There are some cases where people want to be married in the eyes of the church or of their spiritual body, but not married in the eyes of the state. Why would they not want to be married in the eyes of the government? Well, in some cases, widows want to be able to keep the pension from their previous spouse, even if they remarry, and there may be financial reasons for her to say, boy, I don't want the government to stop sending the checks, but I do want to get married, so I'll get married by the church, but I don't want the state to regard it as a marriage. Another situation where people want marriage by the church, but maybe not by the state, is lesbian, gay, or bisexual couples in areas or nations where same-sex marriages aren't legally recognized. And so they're not going to get government recognition, but they still do want recognition from a religious body. There are parts of the world where Muslims or sometimes Mormons are living, and they want to have more than one spouse, but they live in a society that only allows one spouse at a time, and so they just live together as married people with multiple spouses and they want to be married by Muslim or by their particular brand of Mormon authority, but the state isn't going to recognize it and might in fact punish them if they broke the law by having a multiple marriage. There's polyamorous groups where multiple men and multiple women want to have whatever kind of relationships they want to have, and they may even want to call it a marriage. So they'll get some shaman or witch or maybe some church authority to declare whatever they're doing a marriage, and they're not going to get the recognition of the government. Another kind of situation where they might want church marriage but not want a state marriage is an immigrant who is in a nation illegally and wants to be married, but they can't go looking for a marriage license from the government, or the government will know they're there illegally and they'll be in trouble. So they want to be able to deal with the church only in terms of having their marriage recognized and just keep the government out of it if they can. So there's a variety of situations in which people want to be married in the eyes of each other and in the eyes of spiritual authorities, but just don't want the government involved at all. Most of the world's major religions tell people they should marry before having sexual intercourse. Just notice that sentence. This, again, is coming from a fairly anti-religious sociologist, one who says that the nuclear family is a recent invention of Western society. But, you know, that the fact is most of the world's major religions tell people to marry before having sexual intercourse. They teach that unmarried people should not have sex, which they refer to as fornication. Sex with a married person other than one's spouse, called adultery, is generally condemned. For the most part, religious traditions in the world reserve marriage to heterosexual unions. So again, this is just a sociological observation that most religions, for most of history, in most parts of the world, say that sex belongs in marriage, that marriage should be for life, and that sex is to be between a man and a woman who are married. So all the other stuff that sociology says, oh, there's all this variety in marriage, often it is recently approved practices in very secularized societies, which are departing from most societies throughout most of the history of the world. One recent trend is the rise in single-parent or one-parent households. While somewhat more common prior to the 20th century due to the more frequent deaths of spouses, people didn't live as long, and their various plagues came through, or terrible times of war, so somebody gets widowed. So single-parent households were more common in those kinds of situations. In the late 19th and early 20th century, the nuclear family, husband, wife, and kids, became the societal norm in most Western nations. In fact, however, it was the norm before that, but if you lost somebody to illness, you really couldn't help that. But still, the desire was to have a husband and wife. But what was believed to be the prevailing norm is no longer the actual norm. That's the way many of the secular sociologists want it, and that is the way it's increasingly becoming, though it's deviating from what was previously the case in most societies. In the 1950s, most people believed that single-parent households were immoral, but by 1978, only 25% of Americans held that belief. Legal reforms in the 1960s and 70s expanded the rights of non-marital children and unwed mothers, breaking down the distinction between legitimate and illegitimate. It used to be there was a child born outside of marriage was sometimes called an illegitimate child, and one born within marriage was called legitimate. And again, there's a downside to calling certain children illegitimate and frowning on it. There's also a downside to saying, hey, it doesn't matter what kind of situation a child is born in. So it's a challenge. And for Christians to have compassion for those who are born in a less than ideal situation, or for people who have become parents through wrong choices of their own or choices they didn't have in the matter, they've been abandoned by somebody, to have compassion for people in those situations while at the same time having the wisdom to say that's not an ideal situation. And so to realize, to keep shooting for the ideal, aiming for the ideal, while showing compassion, support, and encouragement for people who aren't living in the ideal situation is much better than just saying, there is no such thing as an ideal situation. There is no way that it was meant to be a certain way, and so let's just say anything goes. That is a catastrophic approach. A truly Christian approach will recognize God's ideals and at the same time seek to pour out God's compassion and love for a variety of people in a variety of situations. The declining purchasing power of male wages in the 1970s, along with the increased levels of education among women, led to an increasing percentage of married women with and without kids to enter the workforce. And this change in the economic structure of the U.S., the inability to support a nuclear family on a single wage, had significant ramifications on family life. Many families can't quite make it on one income. And so while it's nice for some women that they can work if they desired to, it's tough sometimes when two people have to work just to make ends meet. And this has had a lot of implications for family life. Women and men began delaying the age of their first marriage in order to invest in their earning power before marriage by spending more time in school. And sometimes even after they're married, they delay having kids so that they can accumulate more money for a few years and get themselves in a good financial position. The increased levels of education among women now earn more than 50% of bachelor's degrees, positioned women to survive economically without the support of a husband. By 1997, 40% of births to unmarried American women were intentional, and despite a still prominent gender gap in pay, women can survive as single mothers. Now again, this isn't quite sifting through the social research, because the matter of truth is that there's much more single motherhood among people without college education. It's not the increase in college degrees that has increased single motherhood. Most people who have college degrees, the women, have a much higher rate of marriage than those who don't have those degrees. But at any rate, the ability of women to earn some money has enabled them at times to live singly rather than with the help of a man. However, despite their ability to support their children, single parents often struggle financially to make ends meet. That's just the fact of the matter. There's some evidence, however, that when single parents move in with their parents, that is, the child's grandparents, then the odds of the single parent-led family falling under the poverty line are reduced by 80%. Well, duh! If you move in with mom and dad and have mom and dad pay the bills out of their wealth that they've accumulated in the course of a marriage, then, yeah, it does make it easier as a single to live under their roof with your bills paid for by their money. But then that's no longer quite being a single parent completely anymore. That's being more of an extended family situation with grandparents helping in the bringing up of the children and certainly helping in the paying of the bills. And again, this is one way to get by when you're in a tough situation. When you've lost a spouse, whether through divorce or marriage, then sometimes the wider family, parents and grandparents, they can help out. It also raises the question, what if you've had a couple generations of the breakdown of the family where you don't recognize the importance of the nuclear family? Then there's no mom and dad to move in with, because they don't have an intact marriage and they haven't accumulated any wealth and they can't help you in the financial struggles. So when a strong marriage remains the ideal, then it becomes a source of help for those who fall short of the ideal. Cohabitation, living together, is an intimate relationship which includes a common living place and which exists without the benefit of legal, cultural, or religious sanction. The cohabiting population, although inclusive of all ages, is mainly made up of those between the ages of 25 and 34. Keep in mind here that sociologist is talking about the situation in North America primarily, even though some of this may be true in other cultures. It's kind of an American-biased observation. It's among young people aged 25 to 34 where cohabitation is the most common. And you see a little graph indicating approval of cohabitation rising, disapproval of cohabitation or just neutrality toward it dropping. It's becoming more and more commonly accepted that it's all right to live together if that's what you want to do. So instead of saying man and woman should get married before they become sexually involved, cohabitation says, hey, you can have sex on the first date. A little more serious step is moving in together, and maybe someday, if you want to get married, you can do that too. But cohabitation is fine if that's what you want to do. What are the reasons for cohabitation or living together? Well, some people say we want to live together first to find out if we're compatible. We're going to test our compatibility before we get married. And if we aren't compatible, then we don't have to get divorced. We can just move out again. If we are compatible, we can get married and we're a lot more likely to succeed. Another reason is they say, well, we're not ready financially yet. We want to live together. We want to have sex. We want the relationship to continue. But we don't want to make it official until we've built up good, solid financial resources. And in some cases, so we can afford a really expensive wedding where the wedding doesn't mean nearly what it used to mean. Another reason for living together. People who want to have same-sex marriage, but it's not legal in a particular society, so the most they can do is live together because they can't get a marriage certificate or document, or polygamy is not legal, but they're going to live together anyway because they're going to do it without government approval. We live in a time, as we've already seen, where divorce is more common, and one way to avoid divorce is don't get married in the first place. If you move in together, you can move out again. That's not always so simple, of course, because sometimes children enter into it. Sometimes after several years, your finances do get very entangled. And so pulling that relationship apart is just as messy as a divorce. But at any rate, that's a reason. Another reason is to avoid complications in taxes or finances. You've got your money, I've got mine. You pay your taxes, I'll pay mine. We'll just keep it all separate. And then there's this. Some people say, hey, it's just a piece of paper. There's not much difference between living together and getting married. And so we're as good as married, even if we aren't actually married. And these are some of the reasons why living together is more common than it used to be. What's the impact of living together? Well, here is somebody who has no religious reasons for saying so, who has no commitment to Christian truth. Here's what they say. Cohabitation does not improve the quality or duration of marriages. It doesn't make them better, and it doesn't make them last longer. Those who cohabit before engagement, about 43% of U.S. couples, report lower marital satisfaction after they do get married, and more negative communication than those who cohabit after engagement. So living together before engagement is more damaging than living together after engagement, and those who cohabit after marriage do even better. So early cohabitors also have a greater potential for divorce. So if you have no belief in Christianity at all, the best approach is don't live together at all before you get married. The next best approach is don't live together until you're at least engaged. And the worst approach is move in together and shack up. We've seen that even a secular sociologist will point out that living together isn't very good for marriage. Let's go into a little more detail with some myths that are considered by the publication First Things. Here's a myth. Living together is a way to try out the relationship before committing to marriage. The truth of the matter is that while test driving a car before you buy one is a good idea, it doesn't apply to marriage. Cohabiting couples who live together often have attitudes like, I can leave any time, and my money versus your money. Married couples have less volatile relationships and a stronger bond. Why? Because of their vow. Promises matter, and a lack of promise means that the marriage is much less likely to succeed. Another myth, living together will give us a stronger marriage. Here's the truth. Many couples think that moving in together can give them a great head start in their marriage, but living together actually harms marriage. Couples who live together before they marry have a divorce rate that is 50% higher than those who don't live together first. Another myth, sharing finances and expenses will make things easier on our relationship. So if we just move in and share the expenses, that'll make it easier. Here's the truth. While sharing finances and expenses seems like the easy thing to do in the beginning, problems do arise. Couples who live together have more financial issues to resolve. Conflicts arise over who's responsible for which bill. And the rights that one partner has to tell the other how to spend their money. Oh, it's my money. You pay that bill. So that financial convenience isn't always so convenient. Another myth. Your sex life goes downhill when you get married. Here's the truth. The level of sexual satisfaction is higher among married couples than for couples who live together. Again, that's sociological research. Couples who live together tend to be less faithful to their partners than married couples. So they tend to step out on each other a lot more easily, and that doesn't exactly contribute to satisfaction either. Another myth, marriage is just a piece of paper. Here's the truth. Emotionally, physically, and spiritually, marriage is so much more than a piece of paper. It's a commitment. Viewing marriage as only a legal arrangement strips it of its meaning and sets the relationship up for failure. If couples don't view marriage as a loving, committed relationship, divorce is almost inevitable. Here's another myth. It's only temporary. The truth is many people start living together hoping they'll be married soon. They say, well, this is just a step toward marriage. It's just temporary and soon we'll be married. However, living together isn't always a stepping stone to marriage. 60% of couples who live together will not go on to get married either because they break up, 39% of cases, or just they just continue living together, 21% of the cases. Another myth, living together is best if children are involved. Let's say you've already had children with someone else and that person has already had children with someone else. Marriage is going to be complicated for both sets of children, so let's just move in together. Best for the kids that way. Here's the truth. Children in cohabiting situations are at risk of emotional and social difficulties, performing poorly in school, having early premarital sex, and having difficulty forming permanent emotional attachments as adults. If the man in the household is not the biological father, children are at greater risk of experiencing physical and sexual abuse. Well, enough about moving in and living together. That's one of those things of our age that has been an attack on traditional marriage. Another attack on traditional marriage and Christian marriage is the idea of same-sex unions. According to the textbook, while homosexuality has existed for thousands of years among both humans and other animals, again, there's your perspective, humans are just one among many kinds of animals, formal marriages between gay and lesbian partners is a relatively recent phenomenon. Given how recent same-sex marriage is in the U.S., there's very little existing data on marital dissolution rates. And so they're considering now, do same-sex unions last, and what impact do same-sex unions have on any children that are adopted or brought into that union? In Norway and Sweden, there were studies done on same-sex unions because it's been legal there longer. The average same-sex couple is older and more educated than the average heterosexual couple. That's one thing the sociologists found. Here's another. Lesbian couples are 200% more likely to divorce than heterosexual couples. And male same-sex couples are 35% more likely to divorce than heterosexuals. So research in those nations where homosexual marriage has been around longer find that the divorce rates are much higher than for heterosexual marriage, and that's just based on sociological research. Why would there be a higher divorce rate in same-sex marriages? Well, so one researcher, Anderson, attributes the higher divorce rate to a combination of factors, including less support from the community and less encouragement or pressure from family and friends to make the marriage last. And this may be true, but notice that one thing that they will not, absolutely will not consider is that just maybe those relationships weren't meant to be in the first place. That may make them less stable to begin with. But because social research has become so radicalized, they can't even consider that as a possible explanation. What about children? What's the impact of same-sex unions on children? One question often raised about same-sex unions is how it influences any children raised in these households. Are children raised by same-sex parents more likely to be lesbian, gay, or even bisexual or asexual? The answer is surprising to some, no. So much research finds out that even if you're a kid who grew up in a same-sex household, you're not more likely to be same-sex in your own desires and relationships. Even so, there are some differences. For instance, children raised in same-sex households have more complex perspectives on sexuality and have well-articulated responses to discrimination. So they see many different kinds of arrangements as acceptable, and they're better able to talk about it than kids who grew up in a heterosexual household, and that's not a big surprise. Further, recent findings, according to the textbook, concerning adolescents raised in planned lesbian families suggest that these children do as well or better on all social indicators as children raised in heterosexual or mixed orientation households. So if two lesbians planned and decided to have children, those children do better than children born to a father and a mother. That's what our textbook says, and that just is not so. Solid sociological research contradicts this claim. The largest random study, the biggest social scientific study that's been done, published in 2012 by sociologist Mark Vigneris, found that having a parent who is or was in a same-sex relationship is generally associated with more negative adult outcomes, especially when compared with adult children from intact biological families. So an intact biological family where you grew up with your father and your mother has much better outcomes than children who grew up with a parent who is or was in a same-sex relationship. That's the overall finding of the study. Adults whose mother or father had a same-sex relationship have lower educational attainment than adults who grew up with their two married biological parents. They were also more likely to receive welfare from the government, to experience depression and other mental difficulties, to smoke, and to be arrested. Rigneris' study examined several other family forms. Although the differences weren't nearly as great as compared with intact biological families, respondents whose parents had a same-sex relationship also generally fared worse than respondents with divorced or single parents. So if you're looking at it, two parents, father and mother, biological parents, is the best situation. The next best is divorced or single parents, and the worst is same-sex parents. That's the findings of the largest sociological study, random survey ever done, and it was done by Rigneris, and he consulted with several very secular, even atheistic, sociologists to check on the objectivity of his research. So same-sex homes are not as helpful as a home with a father and mother. What about homes where dad is gone and single-parent households? Well, 80% of teens in psychiatric hospitals come from fatherless homes. 90% of homeless and runaway children come from fatherless homes. 85% of all youths in prison come from fatherless homes. 72% of adolescent murderers come from fatherless homes. 71% of all pregnant teenagers come from fatherless homes. 63% of youth suicides come from fatherless homes. This is simply what the research indicates. So do not believe any researcher who says that every family arrangement has similar outcomes to every other family arrangement. Now, don't get this research wrong. That doesn't mean 90% of kids from fatherless homes turn into runaways, or 80% of them are in psychiatric hospitals. The point is that those who are in psychiatric hospitals, those who are runaways, those who are in prisons, the overwhelming majority of them do come from fatherless homes. There are kids from fatherless homes who grow up and they overcome that terrible, difficult obstacle of not having a father in their life, but it is still a difficult obstacle, and from the perspective of sociology, leads to many, many negative outcomes. Again, what does Jesus say? Haven't you read that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female and said, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate. Let man not separate God's design for male and female. Let man not tear apart marriages by using divorce simply for trivial reasons. Let man not separate fathers from their own children. God designed the family, and it flourishes best when we live it according to His design And even where we have not lived according to His design, and many of us, all of us, in fact, have not in one way or another, He gives more grace when we seek that grace. When we stop pretending that our sinful choices are the way it's supposed to be and admit them and confess them rather than trying to cover them up to ourselves or covering it with reams of sociological jargon, when we admit that we've fallen short, then He forgives our sins and He brings healing. He brings good things. And so let us thank our Creator for the way He designed us. Let us confess the ways we failed that design. And then let us, with the help of His Holy Spirit and the guidance of His Word, live more and more in keeping with God's design.